Chapter 4. The city was alive. It steamed and roared like a multi-layered beehive, glistening in the frost and mist on the hills above the river Dnieper. Day after day, smoke curled up out of innumerable chimneys into the sky. The streets were hazy with smoke, and the gigantic mounds of fallen snow crunched underfoot. Blocks of houses rose 5, 6, 7 stories high. During the day, the windows were dark, but at night their serried ranks could be seen glowing on the dark blue surface. Electric lights shone like precious stones, perched high on curlicues on the tall lampposts that stretched into the distance as far as the eye could see. In the daytime, the trams, their seats padded with straw in the foreign manner, rumbled easily and smoothly along. Cabs screeched up and down the hills, and the faces of ladies, framed in the dark silver and black fur collars of their coats, seemed especially mysterious and attractive. Covered in white, virgin snow, the parks stood silent and peaceful, and there was no city in the world that had as many parks as the city. They were everywhere, huge areas with alleyways, ravines, chestnut trees, maples and limes. The beauty of the hills above the Dnieper was enhanced by many lovely parks. But the queen of them all was the immortal Imperial Park, broadening out as it climbed upwards in terraced steps, now sparkling with a million flecks of sunlight, now half hidden in gentle twilight. The rotten beams of the ancient parapet formed no barrier to the terrifying drop over the sheer cliff beneath. The steep walls of the cliff, covered with a sprinkling of snow, plunged down onto the terraces far below. Above the road that wound its way along the bank of the great river, the broad terraces in turn stretched into the distance, where they merged into the woods along the bank. The dark, ice-bound river flowed onward into the haze, continuing on to the white Dnieper rapids, the stronghold of the Zaporozhian Cossacks, the Chersonese, and on to the distant sea, out of sight even to anyone standing on the heights of the city. In winter, as in no other city in the world, calm descended on the streets and alleyways of both the upper city on the hills as well as the lower city that was bathed in the light emanating from the frozen Dnieper. Swallowed up by the stone buildings, the roar of the traffic turned into a gentle, muffled hum. All the city's energy that had accumulated during the sunny and thundery summer had now been transformed into light. From 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the lights began to glow in the windows of the houses, in the round electric lamps, in the gas lights, in the lights of house numbers, and in the uninterrupted glass windows of the electricity stations, giving rise to thoughts of the vain and terrible electric future that awaited mankind. Through these uninterrupted glass windows, the machines with their madly, ceaselessly rotating wheels could be seen as they shook the earth's very foundation to the core. Throughout the night, the city played and danced as it glittered and glowed in the iridescent lights, until the morning, when everything was extinguished, and the city became shrouded once more in haze and mist. But outshining everything, visible from miles away, was the electric glow of the white cross held by the gigantic figure of St. Vladimir on the top of Vladimir Hill. Often in the summer, boats on the age-old Dnieper, trapped in dark mists or lost in willow thickets in the river's numerous creeks and backwaters, would see this light and be able to find their way to the city's jetties. In winter, the cross would shine in the black expanse of the heavens, casting its cold, even light on the far, gently sloping bank of the river. At this point, the river was crossed by two bridges. The first, Nikolaevsky Bridge, a weighty chain structure, led to the suburbs on the far bank. The other, tall and slender as an arrow, carried the trains from far, far away, from sprawling, mysterious, multifaceted Moscow. And now, in the winter of 1918, the city lived a strange, unnatural life, a life that very probably will never be repeated in the 20th century. Behind the stone walls of the buildings, every apartment was full to overflowing. Those people who had lived there for ages, the original inhabitants, had crammed and continued to cram themselves into their apartments more and more tightly, as, voluntarily or involuntarily, they admitted all the newcomers streaming into the city. All those, in fact, who had crossed the tall, slender bridge on their journey from the mysterious grey-blue haze to the east. On the run were graying bankers with their wives, talented businessmen leaving behind assistants in Moscow entrusted with the task of maintaining contact with the new world that was being created in the Muscovite kingdom, landlords leaving their houses in the care of clandestine trusted managers, industrialists, merchants, lawyers and political figures. They were joined by corrupt, greedy and cowardly journalists from both Moscow and St. Petersburg, ladies of leisure, respectable ladies from aristocratic families with their delicate daughters, pale, depraved women from St. Petersburg with scarlet-painted lips. On the run, too, were the secretaries of departmental heads, young, docile pederasts, princes and misers, poets and pawnbrokers, and policemen and actresses from the imperial theatres. All these masses of people were crowding into the city, squeezing themselves into a tiny gap. Throughout the spring, immediately after the hetman's election, the city filled up more and more with new arrivals. In the apartments, they slept on settees and chairs. Huge groups sat down to dinner in the wealthier apartments. Countless small cafes opened up, trading far into the night, with coffee and women for sale, together with new, tiny little theatres on whose boards paraded an ever-increasing number of well-known actors who had fled the two capitals and who were now entertaining the populace. Also opening its doors was the famous theatre The Lilac Negro, together with the magnificent nightclub on Nikolaevskaya Street, Ashes to Dust, frequented by poets, producers, actors and artists, where plates clattered until the early hours. New newspapers sprang out of nowhere, carrying sketches by some of the best writers in Russia, savaging the Bolsheviks. The whole time, every day, cabs ferried people from restaurant to restaurant, string orchestras played in cabarets, and the pale, exhausted, drug-ravaged faces of prostitutes shone through the tobacco smoke with an eerie kind of beauty. The city expanded and swelled, like leavened dough escaping from a pot. The gambling clubs were filled with the rustle of cards being played by leading figures from St. Petersburg and from the city itself, together with arrogant, self-important German lieutenants and majors, whom the Russians both feared and respected. Also frequenting the gaming tables were Arabs from Moscow clubs and Ukrainian-Russian landowners, their lives already hanging by a thread. In the café, Maxim, a stocky, charming Romanian with velvety hair and wondrously sad and languorous blue eyes, soared like a nightingale on his violin. The room was lit by two different colours from the lamps, which were wreathed in gypsy shawls, white below and orange above and to the side. Dusty blue silk was spread like starlight across the ceiling, and large diamonds and rust-red Siberian furs glittered and glistened in the blue alcoves. And everywhere there was the smell of burnt coffee, sweat, spirits, and French perfume. Throughout the summer of 1918, the pompous cabbies in their quilted caftans roared recklessly up and down Nikolaevskaya Street, and the rows of car headlights glowed until daybreak. In the shop windows, whole forests of flowers were displayed. Smoked sturgeon hung down in slabs of golden fat, and stamps with two-headed eagles glistened on the bottles of wonderful Abrau champagne. Throughout the summer, more and more newcomers crowded into the city. Among them were men with gristly white faces, or with a greyish stubble on their cheeks, tenor soloists with gleaming patent leather boots, members of the State Duma wearing pince-nez, and whores with resonant surnames. Billiard players escorted whores into shops to buy lipstick, women's cambric drawers with monstrous slits, and hair lacquer. Letters were sent off by the only possible loophole through troubled Poland, although incidentally nobody had any idea what sort of country this new Poland was and what was going on there, to Germany, that great country of honest Teutons, letters requesting visas and transferring money, with people sensing that maybe they would need to travel on farther, to some place where under no circumstances would there be any terrible fighting or the thunder of Bolshevik regiments on the march. People dreamt of France and of Paris, but they became depressed at the realization that getting there would be extremely difficult, maybe even impossible. And while they spent sleepless nights lying on strange settees, thinking such terrible, not always totally lucid thoughts, they were struck by an even more depressing idea. What if the steel cordon were suddenly to break, and allow the grey hordes to crash through. That would be a catastrophe. Such thoughts occurred to people whenever they heard the distant, muffled thump of gunfire. All through that glittering hot summer, firing could inexplicably be heard in the vicinity of the city. Throughout the city itself, the metallic Germans were able to ensure peace and calm, but on the outskirts, the constant dull sound of gunfire was heard. The shelling took place at night, and who was firing at whom, nobody knew. But during the day, people calmed down, as every so often they saw a regiment of German hussars marching along the main street, the Kreschatik, or along Vladimirskaya Street. And what regiments? Proud faces crowned by fluffy fur caps, with rock-like jaws supported by scaly leather straps and stiff ginger moustaches that pointed skywards. Squadrons of horses advanced in strict formation, powerful chestnut horses 17 hands high, and the grey-blue army jackets sat on the 600 hussars, looking like the metal uniforms adorning the massive figures of their leaders on the statues in Berlin. Everybody was so happy to see the Germans that they all calmed down. Grinning gloatingly, safe behind the protection of the barbed wire on the border, they taunted the distant Bolsheviks. "Come on then, if you dare," they shouted. They hated the Bolsheviks. But it wasn't a straightforward hatred, the kind of hatred that simply wants to fight or to kill, but a hissing, cowardly kind of hatred, a furtive, hole-in-the-corner type of hatred. They hated during the night as they fell into a vaguely troubled sleep. They hated during the day, sitting in restaurants, reading newspapers which carried descriptions of Bolsheviks shooting officers and bankers in the back of the neck, and of shopkeepers in Moscow selling horse meat infected with glanders. Everybody without exception hated. Merchants, bankers, industrialists, lawyers, actors, landlords, ladies of leisure, state council members, engineers, doctors, and writers. Then there were the officers. Officers fleeing from the former front line in the north and the west, all of them heading for the city. There were large numbers of them, and the number was growing all the time. Because they were largely penniless, and because it was impossible to disguise the fact of their profession, they were risking their lives. The most difficult thing for them was to acquire false papers, and then make their way across the frontier. They managed, however, to make their way to the city, unshaven and ridden with lice, with hunted expressions, and without their epaulettes. Once in the city, they began to organize their lives so that they could find something to eat and somewhere to live. Among them were old city residents, such as Alexei Turbin, who were on their way back home from the war, returning to their familiar nests with just one thought, to rest and relax, and to start life again, not as an army officer, but as a normal human being. But there were also hundreds and hundreds of others, not from the city, who had found it impossible to remain either in St. Petersburg or in Moscow. Some of them, cuirassiers, cavalry officers, horse guards and hussars, found it easy to float to the top of the turbid foam that characterized the city during these troubled times. The hetman's bodyguard walked around with their outrageous epaulettes, and up to 200 people with oily partings sat down at the hetman's tables, flashing their decaying, yellow, gold-filled teeth. Anyone who could not find a place in the hetman's bodyguard became the guest of women wearing coats with beaver fur collars and owning luxurious oak-paneled apartments in Lipki, the best part of the city. Or else they found themselves a place in restaurants or hotel rooms. The other officers were staff captains from army regiments that had been disbanded, or hussars from the regular army, such as Colonel Niturs, who had fought their way through the war. Hundreds of subalterns and second lieutenants, former students, such as Stepanov Karas, their normal lives interrupted and broken by war and revolution, and other lieutenants like Viktor Viktorovich Mishlaevsky, also former students, but who would never return to their studies. On their arrival in the city, such men in their tattered grey uniforms, with their wounds still not entirely healed and their peeling epaulettes, slept on chairs in their own or other people's apartments, using their greatcoats as blankets, drank vodka, and dashed about the city in a frenzy of activity. And it was this group that hated the Bolsheviks with an uncomplicated and passionate hatred, the sort of hatred that can lead directly to a fight. And then there were the officer cadets, By the beginning of the revolution, there had been 4 military academies remaining in the city: an engineering academy, an artillery academy, and 2 infantry academies. All of them had stopped functioning, shattered in the crossfire between rival groups, and the cadets who had just enrolled, straight out of high school, were thrown out onto the streets, dysfunctional, neither children nor adults, neither military nor civilians. People, in fact, just like the 17-year-old Nikolka Turbin. "That's all very well, of course. The Hetman is in control of everything, but as God is my witness, I still don't know, and very probably will never know, what sort of person this invisible ruler really is, with a title that is more appropriate for the 17th century than the 20th.
"Yes, who exactly is he, Alexei Vasilievich?"
"He's a cavalry general and a very rich landowner called Pavel Petrovich." By some strange quirk of fate and history, his election, which had taken place in the April of that famous year, had been held in a circus. Future historians will no doubt look on this as a rich source of humour. But the citizens, especially those who had settled in the city and who had already experienced the first explosive stirrings of civil war, had no time for humour, or even for any deliberations whatsoever. The election had taken place, thank goodness, with stunning rapidity. The Hetman's reign had begun, and that was splendid. Just so long as meat and bread were available in the markets, there was no shooting in the streets, the Bolsheviks were kept at bay for the Lord's sake, and there were no robberies. And indeed, under the Hetman, all this had more or less been achieved, even perhaps to a considerable extent. It is true that those who had fled to the city from Moscow and St. Petersburg, together with the majority of its inhabitants, laughed at the strange setup which the Hetman had created, calling it a comic opera and an unreal kingdom, like Captain Talberg. Yet their praise for the Hetman was nevertheless genuine. May God grant it continue forever. But whether or not it would continue forever, nobody could say. Not even the Hetman himself. No, sir, not even the Hetman. The fact was that the city, with its police force, military guard, ministries, regular army formations, and newspapers with various different names, was like other cities. Yet what was going on in the wider world outside the city, in the Ukraine proper, which was bigger in size than France, with a population of tens of millions of people, nobody knew. Nobody knew anything, not merely about faraway places, but absurdly about villages that were only some 30 miles away from the city itself. But although nobody knew anything, people still hated with all their heart, and when vague stories about that mysterious region, the countryside, began to circulate, stories of Germans robbing peasants and ruthlessly punishing them by shooting them with machine guns, not only was there not a single voice raised in the peasants' defense, but people sitting in their comfortable drawing rooms under silk lampshades and baring their teeth like wolves could be heard muttering,
"Serves them right. Serves them right, but it's not enough. I'd be even fiercer. They'll remember the revolution all right. The Germans'll teach them. They didn't want their own people. Let them try others."
"Yes, but that's so stupid. So stupid."
"What on earth do you mean, Alexei Vasilievich? They're simply scum. Nothing but wild animals. The Germans will show them, and quite right, too."
Germans. Germans. And everywhere, Germans. Germans. Right, the Germans are here, but out there, somewhere beyond the cordon, are the grey-blue forests and the Bolsheviks. Just the two forces.